Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food.
And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. Hey folks, it's mid-July, and much like the rest of the country, here in the Northeast, we're knee-deep in the local food season. In fact, just this weekend, I went to one of the more than 8,700 farmers markets encompassing the U.S. The popularity has driven collective sales of these farmers markets to be over $1 billion annually, but often a bit inconvenient and too limited in food category selection, and most locations are very seasonal. Farmers markets need to evolve to better service the needs of consumers, producers, processors, and distributors involved. Last month, we learned that more is being done during our live recording at the Boston Public Market with their CEO, Cheryl Cronin. If you haven't been, it's a bit like a fresh revision on a farmer's market and some of the conveniences of big box grocery stores blended in. It's an innovation space for local food, for sure. And since opening, the Boston Public Market has quickly become a modern landmark, providing a full-season cornucopia of raw ingredients, value-added products, and prepared food, all coming from reputable and vetted sources. The Boston Public Market has been a huge win for the city and a great evolution in all local food as an example. But this took some serious heavy lifting from diverse stakeholders to launch and now to operate. Will this happen and be successful elsewhere? Well, we'll have to see, and hopefully it will, but time will tell. For other consumers and producers who don't have access to a Boston Public Market, or less interested in spending a day on a micro-agritourism excursion to the local farmers markets, we also have an opportunity and seen an uptick in CSAs. In fact, in 2015, it is estimated that over 7,000 farms offered direct access community-supported agriculture programs with a total sales topping $225 million. But this too can be limiting. Often CSAs have focused on veg and provide volumes of what is in season in abundance. They're often not a la carte, and they have no curation of what to do with this bounty. So, how much is wasted? Composted? Anecdotally, I guess it's a lot. What is good is recent trends show that local food from regional production is increasingly being found in diverse venues. From produce, proteins, and cereals, and much more, many large grocers have made efforts to add local offerings. And prepared meal delivery services are offering options that source local and differentiated foodstuff to service their higher-end clientele. But few have found contemporary offerings that service the needs of their local community as well as the local producers. And rare few are using modern technology to advance the appreciation for good, fresh food while also sussing out the inefficiencies in a latent food system and food chain without compromising food values. Few empower and bolster the hard work that happens in the field, and few use modern tech to reduce waste or dead loss and assist to have a better division of labor for the producers and even add layers of business intelligence, which is previously not found in small businesses, never mind small farm businesses. Today, we're joined by a founder of an early stage company breaking new ground in this space, an innovator using a unique background in data to bridge the gap of a local food movement by introducing efficiencies that are more in tune with a modern consumer. Today, we welcome CEO and co-founder of Family Dinner, Aaron Baumgartner. Hey, Aaron, how you doing?
Doing well. How are you?
I'm very well. Thanks for taking the time to come on over here. You're based out of Somerville.
Yes, I am. Wasn't that far, and it was a lovely drive.
Lots of parking in the parking lot.
And no traffic in Boston. No construction. No, it's terrible.
It's terrible.
It's great to be here.
Takes about an hour and a half to come across town. Well, we only record right here in Cambridge, but nonetheless, thanks for making the effort to come on over.
My pleasure.
Hey, so I gave a little bit of an introduction around what's happening with local food, how we access that through farmers markets and through CSAs. What are you doing with Family Dinner, And what problem are you trying to address?
Sure. So Family Dinner kind of has two stories to tell. The first of which is that we are a farmers market delivery service. And so we've created a distributed network of local farms. And through that, we're trying to work to bring local meat and fish and grains and produce to people's homes. We then send them an email that says, this is who grew your stuff. This is what's in your share this week. Here's how to cook it. Here's how to reuse your leftovers. All with an idea of trying to eliminate waste. So that's sort of the front page story. On the second page is that we're trying to use data and predictive analytics to make the local food supply chain more efficient and to help farmers connect to consumers in a more direct manner. And we're doing this because we know that the national food system is optimized for exactly one thing, which is profit, right? It doesn't have our best interest in mind. It doesn't have the best interest of animals or the food that's being grown in mind. It's just profit. And we know that there are alternatives to it. You just mentioned two of them, CSAs, farmers markets. They're both great, but in our view, they're both suboptimal solutions.
So take me through the process, if you would. I've signed up for Family Dinner. I am now a member of your service, and I get a weekly mailer saying, here's what is in the kitty. Here's what I can pick from. Where do I go from there?
Sure. So you become a Family Dinner member, and you have an online subscription with us. Orders process weekly, and customers are either in unless they opt to be out. So for you as the customer, that's really handy because maybe you travel a lot, or maybe you don't want a delivery every week. You can just click into the system and you won't be charged and you won't receive a delivery that week. So it allows for a lot of flexibility on the customer end. Orders for us process on Monday. So every Monday morning, I know exactly how many orders I have coming in, and how much I need to purchase to meet those demands. Customers purchase shares that are either omnivore or paleo or pescatarian or vegetarian, and then I spend the week curating that share myself. So trying to find what's best in local fish, trying to find what's coming out of the ground that week, trying to talk to local bakers to think about things that will marry together in a harmonious way so that when you get your share every week, it looks like something holistic, and you're ready and excited to dive in and start preparing it.
Okay, and if we have a dairy allergy in the family and I don't like asparagus, how is that done?
That works very easily. We can accommodate all of your allergies and aversions. A lot of our customers have one or two things that they just never want. Please never bring me mushrooms. Which I don't understand because I love them, but I get that people have their different allergies and aversions. We'll always substitute that out. It does become complicated if somebody doesn't want meat or dairy or gluten and doesn't like green vegetables and hates tomatoes and fruit. There we're left with not a lot of choices. But the fewer aversions and allergies, we can certainly accommodate.
We are in the Northeast, so mm-hmm. we have some reality that now, look, we're saying this is kind of like our peak season. We're going into harvest season coming in the fall.
Yes.
You got a plethora of things to pick from. But in the off seasons, and you know, when you can source more of the local products, or less of local products, but more of the proteins, mm-hmm. How do you then properly curate that for us?
We got to hustle. We got to hustle around to find different things. And so now you're talking to people who are growing things hydroponically. You're talking to people who are growing in freight farms. You're talking to folks who are growing in greenhouses. So, you know, no, you're not going to get, you know, squash in the winter, the same that you would get in the summer and fall. But there's a lot of things. So microgreens and kales and herbs and tomatoes, you can get all of that throughout the year. You have to work hard.
It sounds like when I go to a white tablecloth restaurant and I look what's on the specials for that week, if I'm in there in the winter and the chef makes a certain recommendation that, you know, doesn't have strawberries on it because the strawberries are not in season, I listen to them and say, wow, this is going to be the most vibrant, delicious food. Are you doing effectively the same for your user base?
We're really trying to do that and trying to encourage people to eat within the season. And it's important not just because of the way that the food is sourced, but also how it tastes, right? A tomato in the winter in New England tastes like garbage, right? Because it's flown in from wherever. It was picked when it was hard. It was gassed along the way. It's traveled 6,000 miles and it tastes like wet cardboard, right? So why would you want to eat it anyway? But apparently around here, every time you get a sandwich, we're used to having a tomato on it. So just because we always have, we're still used to it. but it's neither good for the environment, it's not well-grown food, and it's also gross. So isn't there a better way? Wouldn't you rather have something, wouldn't you rather focus on microgreens or something that's fresh and local and also delicious as part of your meal? So there is a lot of gentle education that we're trying to do as we go through this process.
And is part of that gentle education also opening the ideas of biodiversity? Because often we get refined to your point, we only see tomatoes, or we go to a grocery store and you only get a few options of carrots. But mm-hmm. there are hundreds of types of mm-hmm. carrots that you can actually pick from, multicolored, from multi-flavors, and they have different aesthetics, mouthfeel, everything.
Right.
Do you work with your producers all the way up through your consumers to help add that diversity throughout your offerings?
Yes. So when our farmers are talking to us about, we've got these gorgeous purple carrots and people haven't seen them before. And sometimes we'll get emails from people that say like, I'm so sorry, the carrots you sent me are purple. And it's like, yes, they are. It's this different form. And you get to share with people, you know, these are heirloom varietals of tomatoes or eggplants or beans. And so you get to introduce new things into people's homes. And also it takes a little bit of the fear away. Maybe you would never reach for those in the grocery store, but because they've shown up at your doorstep, now you've got to do something with them. And we've also given you the ideas as to how to prep them, how to consume them, the best way to store them, things like that.
It's fascinating because I think in 2018 was the first year that consumers spent more money, more of their resources on going out to dinner mm-hmm. rather than what they actually bought at home, which mm-hmm. usually allocate. You know, we don't think twice about going to spend $40 per plate, $50 per plate when we go out to a restaurant. But people hem and haw about buying a better quality product when they come and put it in their own pantry, or they have to use grass-fed milk or whatever it may
right.
be. How do you break down that barrier, that mindset of the consumer that has intrigue in what's actually happening with this curated, higher-end, almost chef-quality mm-hmm. food? But boy, I'm going to serve it in my own kitchen. Where am I missing here?
So I think that there's a step. Yes, people are spending a lot of money in restaurants, but people are also increasingly dabbling in these many, many meal kit services that are out there. I think that there is a desire to have the experience of cooking and to know that you're doing this for your family or for yourself. So I think that that is growing in parallel to people eating out more and more. The question of the price and why people are willing to do something a little bit more high-end here is the touch of understanding that everything that comes into your share has passed through my hands, right? Has passed through our hands. We go to the farms, we see things being planted, we visit the animals, we visit production facilities so that we can ensure and promise you that everything that's showing up meets our standards. And so that you know directly where your food that's coming into your home is coming from. And so there is that kind of curated experience that I think people enjoy. Lastly, our customers like to say things like, when the share comes to their house, they don't know what's in it, right? It comes on Saturday morning or Tuesday afternoon, depending on your day. And you open up this bag, and people have told us many times that it feels like Christmas morning, right? There's this fun experience in there. One of the things we get the most comments about is that there's always like a little treat, like a brownie or candy or something in there, and like families fight over it. But it's fun to like, it just adds this element of fun to the whole experience. And that's the feedback we've heard.
It's like the chocolate on the pillow at the hotel room, right?
That's right. That's
yeah.
us.
Right. That's good. Well sourced.
Local chocolate.
That's right. One of the reasons people, I think, support CSAs or local food is because it is servicing their communities, right? And these are one of the things that you hear often. But, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be retention for the year coming back. Because if you get some pretty poor quality food right. coming through it, through your CSA or going to the farmer's market, you'll give it a go once or twice. But
right.
if it tastes poorly, you're not coming back.
And why would you?
Right. So as the ultimate curator here, what are you doing for the quality assurance side? And then how do you work with producers to guarantee that you're getting this quality sustenance coming through your supply chain?
So I am on the farms every week. I go and visit our farms. I have been talking to farmers about what we'd like to see planted. And in that way, and we can talk about this more later, is where the predictive analytics side of it comes in. Because I can tell them exactly where I can predict our company will be vis-a-vis growth in 3 months, 6 months, 9. So that I can sit down with them and say, okay, you're doing your crop planning. I know that by September of this year, I'm going to want 500 pounds of eggplant a week of this variety. You plant it for me with the confidence that I will buy it all from you. And I think it's a good thing for the farmer. So it becomes very hands-on. I like to eat. So I've tasted everything. I've eaten everything that comes into every share each week. So I have the confidence that it is delicious and it is extraordinarily fresh.
Hmm. You come at it from an interesting data background. Mm. And you've used terms like predictive analytics, which often many producers aren't going to be as familiar with. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when broken down to looking at, well, when things repeat, I can look at it again and make better analysis and help you be proactive in planning for these, you know, trends or interests or what my intrigue is for sourcing this food for my consumers from your point of view. How are you now, and we'll get into your background a little bit more, but how are you using this as you're doing this analysis, taking this all in? How are you starting to aggregate that information to start to look forward towards a predictive analytics?
So there's three, I'll maybe take a step back if I can. There's three technologies that kind of make this business hum and that make it a different model than either CSAs or farmers markets. And we can explain where the inconveniences and inefficiencies are in both. But for us, we operate on an e-commerce subscription-based platform. And this means that it allows customers an enormous amount of flexibility in their ordering so that there's no waste from that consumer side. But it also feeds all that data on customer activity, lifetime customer value, where your growth is going, et cetera, and that leads us into the predictive modeling that we're able to do to try to figure out where are we going to be? What is the largest growth sector for us? Do we see a huge boom in people going paleo or people who are more interested in buying just fresh fish? And if so, does that encourage us to grow in different directions? And finally, the third technology that we use has to do with the last mile logistics. So this kind of problem of the traveling salesman. And what we're trying to do is use route optimization software to really decrease the time that our drivers are driving for CO2 emissions, but also for the safety of the food and for the convenience of the customer. And all that means that with 15 people, we can pack, deliver, and drive about 250 shares all around the greater Boston area in about 2.5 hours.
Hmm. So you centralize around greater Boston. Where do you currently, all communities within Boston and Metro West and surrounding?
Mm-hmm. So we go north of the city by about 30 miles. We go all the way west to Newton, Framingham area, and down into the South Shore. And we will expand those deliveries as saturation requires. So as there are more opportunities to grow and it makes sense with the routing, then we will grow in new geographies. And the reason that's really, all of these things are really important for farmers is because if you're a farmer, there's two ways of getting your stuff out to the world, right? You can either do the CSA model where people come to you. And that's awesome for you because, you know, they're taking the financial burden for you. They're giving you money in advance for the things that you're going to grow. And every week you're going to stick the things you grow in a box and people are going to take it, right? That's great for the farmers. Less convenient for the consumer because they still have to go to the farm. Maybe less convenient for the consumer because they really don't love parsnips or rutabaga or any of those things. And less convenient for the consumer because there isn't that diversity that you're talking about. Now you still got to go get your meat and your fish and your eggs and your grains, et cetera, et cetera. The other way that they do it is by going to farmers markets, right? You load up your truck, you show up at this thing, and it's great for you as a consumer because it's fun, right? You're wandering around, you got this warm and fuzzy feeling and this whole thing, but it's not that fantastic for the farmers themselves. Right? If it pours that day, like, what the hell are you supposed to do, right? There's no way to move your product. You're going to go back to your farm with everything that you showed up with, and all of that time, money, and food goes to waste, right? In both of those situations, the farmers are geographically limited to the areas of either people coming to their farm or them being willing to show up at farmers markets. So the geographical limitations are strong. But if you blow the doors off of that, and you operate online through this e-commerce subscription platform, now a farm in Lexington, Massachusetts can service somebody who lives on the South Shore, which would never happen without this type of hybridization of the models.
There you go. It's part of that last part of your three-prong approach here, the last mile logistics. Mm-hmm. Here in logistics, it's the return trip is where you make all the money. So maybe it's the producers that are going to buy all your future shares, right? You just
That's
keep
right.
looping them around and taking care of.
It's going to be the full circle.
Boom. Yeah. Like that. You can keep that one. That's a little tidbit for you.
I appreciate that.
Hey,
thank you.
You're welcome. Tell us a little bit more about how this all began.
Sure. So my husband and I started this company when I was still working at MIT. And we had this idea like, hey, wouldn't it be neat if we did this thing. And he was in my ear, like, let's do it. Let's start this thing. And it's like, yeah, with what spare time? Like, we both work in tech, and it just was an overwhelming idea to take on. But then we decided, you know what, let's do it. Let's beta test this thing. Let's get 7 or 10 friends to let us bring them their groceries. We literally sent our friends an email that says, we have this wild idea. Would you let us bring us your groceries every week? And would you pay us for it? It was so analog and so inefficient at the time that our friends would literally send us a text if they wanted a delivery that week, and we would run around and source things, and then they would PayPal us money, and we would drive it to their homes, and, you know, like, give everybody a hug and, you know, see the kids and whatever. And that's how it worked in the beginning. And it's insane to think about how inefficient and, like, not optimized that situation was, but it allowed us to grow. And it allowed us to learn and explore different softwares and modify the things that we needed for our own requirements. And it also allowed us to figure out how to best grow at and achieve the scale that we were looking for.
It does obviously service your community, and there's some growth within this community. But are you building on a technology framework that can service other communities as well?
Sure. So when we started with our 7 or 10 friends, that was about a year and a half ago. Now we have 375 active customers who can sign in and get a share at any given week. And we're doing about 250 deliveries weekly. So the growth within 18 months is fairly significant. I think that the model itself is transferable, but not perfectly, right? You couldn't take this exact thing and put it down in Portland or Portsmouth or Providence. There's many parts of it that could be easily moved over. But a lot of it is like the dirt and sweat and handshaking and knowing farmers and building trust. And that just has to be done. You can't outsource that. You've got to go and do that work so that your consumer knows that you, as the company manager or the person who's working there, is going to do the work, is going to see these things. And so, yeah, you could build that, but you'd have to have a person who's willing to build the bridges, explain to the farmers why this is valuable. And it's, you know, it's a shaky conversation at first because it's different. But that value becomes really clear very quickly to them, in my opinion. And so I think that's the work that would have to be done if you were going to move this thing elsewhere. But I got to tell you, that's my dream, right? I would love for this small distributed network that we have to grow and multiply and to build a nationwide network of distributed farms, right? As you mentioned, there are 8,700 farmers markets in the country every year. So there's a demand, there's a need, there's a bounty and a plenty here. Can't we do better to connect the dots? And that's what we're trying to do.
So a little bit more about your background and how data has played into that. So Aaron Baumgartner is a former assistant director of MIT's Sensible City Lab in the MIT's Department of Urban Studies and Planning, a lab that used data to understand complex systems. I also read a quote of yours saying that during your time at MIT that people are not just data points, that you have to think about the human experience in the city. And that couldn't be more true relating to food chains and food system chains, especially evolutions of that. So how did your work in smart city planning and design influence the launch of Family Dinner?
So the Sensible City Lab at MIT, as you mentioned, is really trying to use data to understand things that hadn't been seen before. And it's so easy to say that we're just understanding big data and we're trying to analyze big data. But the biggest step that we were always trying to do is to use that data to tell stories. It's not sufficient for us within MIT and within the academic community to understand the crucial questions that are happening in a city around health, transportation, waste systems, environmental factors. It's not sufficient for us to just understand that and expect a larger public to be on board with making changes or informing policy or changing their behavior. It's not enough. You have to find a way to really turn all that nerdy scientific data talk into English so that you can explain to people why what you're doing matters, right? Why does congestion matter in the city? Why does wastewater really matter? And if you put that through data visualization and through general public publications, you can inform a public conversation and do that gentle education that I was talking about earlier. So how did this inform what I want to do now? With these complex systems, I think food is one. It's maybe the most. You know this probably better than anybody. And so how do you use data to understand this complex system, to understand where things come from, to understand what goes into growing something, not just what goes into growing it from a resources perspective and CO2 emissions, but labor, antibiotics, pesticides, all those different things, that whole spectrum. How do you use technology to better understand that and to turn those findings out to a general public so that they can be willing to make a different decision, so that they can be willing to make demands on having better food, a better system, and something that's more holistically optimized?
Yeah, I mean, in technology, especially related to cities, where depending on who you listen to, some people say 80% of the population by 2050 are going to be in cities. So they have received a lot of interest in areas that we are talking about, materials of products going in and out of cities, the waste coming out, as you had mentioned, overcrowding, congestion, air quality, water quality concerns, sea level rise, all these things, which are in most of our cities are built around marine environments, mm-hmm. right? So all these things are becoming tip of the tongue, but we still have to feed all of these people. And one of the things that has come up often in those discussions are things like the Internet of Things and around cities and data trails and smart city design analytics. Those are all becoming big business related to these many sectors. Food and ag seem to be a bit behind the times on some of those. So in your opinion, your professional opinion, blending both your worlds here, are we going to continue to see a similar tech advancement, additional use of data in food and its production in years to come? And if so, is it going to be revolutionary?
My answer is that I really hope so. I think that there's an issue in that there's an intentional lack of transparency in between the folks who grow the majority of our food, so big agricultural business, and us who eat it, right? You walk through the grocery store and the entire store is blanketed with the words like natural and farm and fresh. But as we've said before, like, those words have absolutely zero meaning, right? They have absolutely zero metrics attached to them quantitatively. And so you may as well say that, like, this box of cereal is awesome or cool, right? There are no metrics there. So I think that that lack of transparency is very, very intentional. I think a lot of the work that we were able to do in the Sensible City Lab at MIT is really around citizen science. It's us going out and installing sensors on things to try to figure out their path through a city. It's us taking data sets, crunching them, and putting them out as visualizations so that people can understand. The food system is so, so much more layered and intentionally foggy. But what we're trying to do is use this data that we know is available. Very simple things like, how far does a tomato travel to get to you, right? To tell the story of the normal condition of food, and to also talk to people on an emotional level about how things can be better. You've brought up a really fascinating question, right? So we know that rapid urbanization is a real problem, right? Currently, about, 56% of people live in cities. Cities take about 80% of the energy and emit over 80% of CO2 emissions. Now, what happens when we've got 9.8 billion people on the planet by 2050? You've got an issue. And in food, you've got a real issue. Because as this rapid urbanization happens, people are gaining wealth, which is fantastic. But as people gain wealth, their expectations for food change, right? So now that people are wealthier, now that people are living in cities, which has obviously its upsides, people are going to start to eat more and more meat, which is a problem we know because of all the water, the land use, the CO2 emissions, and everything else that goes along with industrial meat production. Again, you know this absolutely better than anyone. I should turn this back over to you. But I think that will be a real problem. And the answer isn't, in my opinion, just turning to lab-based meats, right? Just turning to things that are grown in a lab to sort of replicate a hamburger. That's not necessarily the answer. The answer might be to be thinking the way that Dan Barber does about changing what's on your plate entirely. And how do you convince people to change something that's so ingrained in them? Now you've got to go back to data, and you've got to go back to storytelling. Because if you can make it personal for people without making them feel like crap about what they do every day, if you can make it personal, then you can potentially encourage people to change their really deeply ingrained comportment, right? And so that's what we're trying to do. That's one of the things that we're trying to think about. But I think that, you know, as you mentioned, this is going to be one of the largest issues that we face, is how are you going to feed 10 billion people by 2050 who are going to eat something like more than 60% more meat than any of us ate in 2007?
It is a known problem, increasingly aware people are becoming, to your point around how they select their diet based off of the impact on the environment, right? And what I also find intriguing on the city side of things is I'm familiar with some of the work that groups like Sasaki Associates have done in looking at some of the Chinese cities that are almost creating agricultural cities that are of 10 million people, mm-hmm. which would be a relatively mid-sized city in some of the Chinese environments. But they're building almost like a little buffer system where they're putting agricultural communities or agricultural lands surrounding these cities so they become more self-sufficient. So it's not just a raw materials coming in, mm-hmm. but we're actually making more autonomous environments so that it can support itself getting out of this, you know, monoculture, bringing things from all over the world.
Right.
Is that a trend from your perspective? Is that something you looked at when you were at MIT to make these autonomous cities more applicable?
I mean, I think that's a really interesting topic. That's not something that the lab that I worked in covered. There's groups at the Media Lab that are doing that type of work. But I think from my personal opinion, I think that's really fascinating from a city's systems perspective, but also from a personal experience perspective, right? If you're getting more and more people out into community gardens, even if your community is 10 million people, and people are touching their own food and touching the source of it, I think that that really matters. And that goes a long way to helping people understand where things come from, why that's valuable, and why it's important to choose option A of locally grown food versus option B. So I think that a person's own emotions behind it, though that's not really, again, quantitative, I think that's extremely important.
Yeah, and it is interesting to look at many of the when you have international friends and they're one generation away from their families or their grandparents still have farms, and we have less of that connection in this country where we've 0.7% of our population are still producing our food. That has become we are so separated behind that, as you said, the foggy systems within our foggy mentality within the systems of lack of transparency is without a doubt a known and pending problem. But I would say if we could get to more of those autonomous cities, you would think that would have to do well for family dinner in the future, right? I mean, you could use your technology for that would service that regional build them quite nicely.
Listen, that would deal with my last mile logistics problem really, really
no
well.
Doubt.
If it was one city with 10 million people and 10 million potential customers, I think, you know, let's do it. Let's launch in China. Let's go.
I like it.
I mean, I think if I can just jump in, I think something you brought up is really interesting. You know, you're talking about a lot of friends having families who one generation removed worked on farms, et cetera, et cetera. What we're trying to do is actually not that insane. This isn't a wild innovation. We're trying to use technology to kind of like take a U-turn, right, and go back to the way that things were, right, when you sourced all of your food locally, when the farmer's market wasn't just this cute thing that you did on Saturdays for one quarter of the year, when that's how people got their food. So we're trying to use more sophisticated advanced techniques to go back to kind of like the way things were. And so I think that personal experience and having this be part of our history is really important.
I do agree. And everything from getting our kids more exposed to sowing seeds and the production of crops in our educational systems, having people grow their victory gardens, the more it's tangible, the more they can respect how difficult it is to produce food, the more appreciative they'll be of the quality of food that we have in abundance many times. And hopefully that also would reduce some of our waste issues.
That's exactly the point, right? Yeah. As you start to associate a value to something a little bit more, right? As you know what growing a cucumber takes, how long it takes, maybe you're going to spend a little bit more time thinking about waste, about that thing, and maybe you're willing to use it a little bit past its date than you normally would be, right? Maybe you're going to treat it as something that's a little bit more of a precious commodity because you know exactly all the elements that went into it. You touched on another topic, which is ubiquity, right? There is food absolutely everywhere, but it's also really scarce. And I think it's that dichotomy, the ubiquity scarcity, that I find terrifying. And so as you're walking through the public space, we don't even think anymore that it's insane that there are chicken fingers at the gas station and pizza, right? Why is that there? What's wrong with our eating that we need chicken fingers at a gas station? And I don't want to harp on on that type of eating, because I know that a lot of communities rely on these less formal eating environments. I know that to be true. But I think that with that infrastructure, we can certainly do a lot better. And that's one of my goals as with Family Dinner, is to move out of something that's just this kind of upper crust, almost precious environment that we're in, and to work systematically with the structures that we have in place to be getting this type of food, if we believe it's better for you, if we believe it's better for the environment, out into a much broader audience.
Well, I would absolutely agree, because if people start adding those additional values to it as preventative health care, if they look at it as if they're an environmentalist, if they care about social welfare, whatever that thread that they need to pull or they have intrigue in pulling, a better food system is in a direct accordance with that. And so we're not going to see any gas station chicken fingers on the future family dinner menus?
No, there aren't. But what if I could get gas station kale out there, I would do it. Gas station, you know, pasture-raised eggs, I'm into it. I want people to start asking questions of their food, right? Because until you start looking at the data, you don't really know about the questions that you should be asking. You don't know about the fog that I mentioned in between the, you know, the quote-unquote, by the way, growers. I think it's almost an absurd term, right? There are no farmers on factory farms, right? That's just technology at work. That's science and technology at work. And I've got nothing against technology and science, obviously. But when your science and your technology is working so hard to optimize and make an efficient a system so, so efficient that so many other things are at risk, everything that you mentioned, environment, animal welfare, worker welfare, and by the way, quality and taste, I think that's a problem.
Yeah. We've used technology to milk out all those values rather than to preserve them and find efficiencies in systems.
No pun intended.
There you go. Well, I would guess as you're having these conversations with folks in Cambridge or some of, you know, your buyers and your consumers or even folks within the community, the fact that you have this background in MIT, the predictive analytics is impressive. But probably when you're talking to your producers, they're more impressed when you kick back, sit down and have a beer and explain to them you played semi-pro football.
Yes.
For the Boston Militia. Please tell us more.
Oh, this is it was an extraordinary experience. So for a long time, I played for the Boston Women's Ultimate Frisbee team. So it's one of the national teams there, and then moved on from frisbee to women's full contact football. Again, this is part of a national league. I played for the Boston Militia for 3 years and then joined the Boston Renegades as a part owner of that team. And when I was playing, I played safety and receiver. And that was, you know, that was a lot of fun. I think it's an extraordinary story to tell as we're starting to see more and more about the U.S. women's soccer team, who are enormously successful and really just still fighting for attention. You know, these women who play football are playing the exact same game as the men. They're hitting just as hard. All the time that goes into it, all the practice, all the travel is still there. And the Boston team is wildly successful, won many national titles. And the press coverage and the attention that you get from the public is very, very low.
Hmm.
So I think it was really empowering and exciting to be a part of this extraordinary group of women. And I think it necessarily makes you a little bit tougher.
I would think so, for many reasons, right?
Yeah.
Many layers
yeah.
deep, no doubt about it. All right, Aaron, so where can our listening audience learn more about Family Dinner? Is the website, how can they sign up? What would be the best approach for them?
Sure, so they can always visit us at sharefamilydinner.com. That's our website. We're on social media at sharefamilydinner on Instagram and Facebook. And anytime they want to be in touch with me, I love talking to folks. I could gab about food probably all day long. They can, any email on the website always comes through me and my husband and our team. So we are just thrilled to talk to people all the time.
And I would guess you could break down who's the better free safety back in the day, Ronnie Lott, maybe, you know, Ty Law, I don't know.
Absolutely, but they're going to have to provide the beer on that one.
That's right. That's part of the prerequisite, so. I'll just close by saying I'm excited by this, not only being from New England and seeing these evolutions come out of our space. It's a bit of the game theory for us. We don't produce that much of our own food. We have to become better in sourcing it, preserving those values of what we do provide, and really empowering more of our producers to be part of that equation. I think what you're doing here, Aaron, with Family Dinner is very exciting because it's taking all of the stakeholders involved and providing them the tools, the resources in a modern flavor, and starting to be smarter in getting that to the folks that care about this and engaging more folks to care about these things. And that's exciting. Where it blends from there of developing a, you know, software as a service platform ecosystem, developing it as a technology framework that can scale, or working as, you know, opportunities down the line for more people to partake and replicate this in other environments.
That's right.
It's exciting. Those are all things of an innovation economy, right? And probably similar to what you have seen in smart city planning, where this has spawned a lot of enthusiasm and excitement for people to look at things differently. Mm-hmm. And I hope we continue to look at things differently, and hope a lot of our audience will come out and find new potential. And after hearing what you've done and seeing if we can not only source our food better, but also develop new businesses and new ideas tied to local food that is not just our farmers markets and CSAs.
Right. And eat better.
And eat better. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for taking the time. I learned a great deal. I appreciate
you. Thank you so much. This is a pleasure.
Absolutely. So take care. Speak soon.
Talk to you soon.